I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, December 13th. We wake up today into a world where, according to Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, Chief Justice John Roberts has lost control of the Supreme Court. She says Texas's bounty scheme for banning abortions worries the Chief Justice, but his conservative colleagues think it's just fine. And she says the court on Friday handed states, other states, a roadmap for how to ban abortion without even deciding the Texas case. And it's a world in which Jim Newell from Slate says the Democrats could have gerrymandered away a seat from the Republicans in Congress but didn't do it. A world in which Newell wrote a feature called This Week in Mark Meadows, and a world in which, as Newell put it, Dr. Oz joins a robust list of nutso Senate races already underway. Oh, and it's a world in which Chris Wallace suddenly announced that he's leaving Fox and going to CNN, of all places. Reportedly, he couldn't take Fox's increasingly off-the-rails conspiracy theory radicalism anymore. And that's quite enough to get us going for today with both Jim Newell, senior politics writer for Slate, and Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts their podcast, Amicus. Dahlia and Jim, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
And Jim, be patient for a few minutes while I ask Dahlia about some of her reporting first. And Dahlia, for one thing, this Texas abortion ban, regardless of the legal analysis, is having real effects on countless Texas women and families right now because five justices allowed it to stand while other judicial challenges continue. So would you start, so that we're grounded in humanity and not in the law, with the real-world consequences of this interim decision right now as you see them?
Yeah, and thank you for framing it that way, Brian. I went back this morning and counted how many times the word woman or pregnant appeared in the opinions of the justices in the majority, and other than citing the statute itself, it's not there. There's no recognition that this is affecting real people. And yeah, it's 103 days since this law has gone into effect. It has, for all intents and purposes, stopped providers from giving abortions to pregnant people in Texas at 6 weeks. That's before many, many people know they're pregnant, and 90% of abortions would typically happen after. And the stories we're hearing are chilling and horrifying about folks, if they can get the resources, headed to Oklahoma, where there's now 4-week waits at clinics in Louisiana, other states where they're trying to go to get services that they can't get, and just really, really heartbreaking tales of victims of rape, of in abusive relationships, of incest, who are just, if they can get the money and they can take the time to travel, traveling huge, vast distances to get services that are supposed to be protected in the Constitution.
On the 5-4 majority letting the law stand for now on Friday while those other federal court challenges take place, do you know the rationale for that? I'm sure you've read through the decisions that the whatever writing the justices handed down. If the current Supreme Court standard is no state might place an undue burden, the undue burden standard from the 1992 case, undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion, a 6-week cutoff seems like it's an undue burden to almost every person in the state who would have sought an abortion before. So how did they rationalize their way out of that?
Well, the issue of whether Roe and Casey were good law was not on the table. It was not a part of this opinion. Really, the only thing the court was trying to figure out is if this incredibly circuitous. I think Justice Elena Kagan at oral argument in SB 8 said some genius was her way of describing this system whereby there's no state enforcement and only individuals have a cause of action. Any American has a cause of action to sue. That was the issue. And so the court didn't get to the issue you're raising. That was certainly raised in the Dobbs case, the Mississippi ban. But interestingly, this entire thing, until you get to Sonia Sotomayor's dissent, doesn't even ask questions about how you know, if you have a viability standard that is currently set at 24 weeks, maybe 23 weeks, and you have a 6-week all-out ban, it absolutely nullifies Roe v. Wade. The first person who writes the word nullification is Chief Justice John Roberts, and he's in that 4 you're describing in the 5-4.
Before we get to Chief Justice Roberts, Dahlia, just to pin down the other half of the ruling on Friday for people who may be confused, the ruling that came down allowed abortion providers to challenge the near total abortion ban from Texas in federal court. The state of Texas had hoped the court would say the law wasn't even reviewable. And yet, you say, they provided a roadmap for other states to ban abortions. It's almost a contradiction. How so?
Well, it was really interesting. I noticed when the decision came down in the first hour or two on Friday morning, there was real confusion about whether to call this a win for the abortion providers or a win for Texas. And it was very, very confusing. And in fact, confusing that really what you ultimately had was an 8-1 decision to allow the providers to go ahead and sue some people. So it looked as though, I think initially, this was a big, big win for the providers. And it really required going back and reading and understanding that that 8-1 decision was to allow 4 state actors, licensing agents, that the Neil Gorsuch majority opinion calls them executive state licensing officials. Those people can be subject to suit, so the abortion providers can go ahead and sue them to try to get this law enjoined. But in fact, it does nothing to stop the state of Texas from continuing to have a law that says that anyone in the country can haul a provider or someone who, quote, aids and abets a provider or somebody who drives the Uber to take someone to a clinic to procure an abortion. All of those people are still in the crosshairs. And so I think part of what was confusing was, even though there is this tiny wormhole by which the providers could presumably stop some people from enforcing this law, the fact is it does nothing to set aside the law in its entirety and thus does really nothing to protect providers. And as I understand it right now, this is going to go back to Judge Pittman. He's the district court judge who kind of has care and custody of this case. He'll try to figure out what kind of injunction he can craft. And then it goes back up to the Fifth Circuit, which was very, very quick to uphold this law and did it by short-circuiting the district court. And so I think in a deep, deep sense, what the court looks to be doing is saying, sure, providers, you're going to live to litigate another day, but best of luck on the next round.
So, Chief Justice Roberts, as you point out, concurred in part and dissented in part from Friday's ruling, and the language you quote from his dissent is stark, saying if the Texas law stands, quote, the Constitution itself becomes a solemn mockery. The Constitution itself becomes a solemn mockery. The Bush-appointed John Roberts said that.
He did say that, and we should be really clear that only a week earlier, when they were hearing the big 15-week Mississippi case, that's the one that really now looks as though it may lay the groundwork to outright overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, John Roberts was a skeptic. He was not on the fence. I don't think anyone believed, Brian, that John Roberts secretly liked Roe v. Wade. I think that it's been clear for a long time that he holds his nose and says this is the law of the land. But it was really interesting to see that John Roberts, who showed up a week earlier in the Mississippi case, looking like he was pretty much ready to move that viability line that you described from 24 weeks to 15 weeks with the stroke of a pen, that John Roberts, writing in this case, saying the entire credibility, legitimacy, and supremacy of the U.S. Supreme Court is on the line, and that if the court allows this to happen, you quoted the word mockery, if the court allows this to happen, it will be open season. States will be nullifying other fundamental constitutional rights willy-nilly, and you can sense this panic in his opinion that not one of the 5 more conservative justices is swayed by that or even bothered by that.
And now, along with Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the courts and the law for Slate. Jim Newell, senior politics writer for Slate. Jim, thanks for your patience. And you're looking at the 2022 elections and the January 6th committee, among other things. But do you think, however far the Supreme Court goes toward undoing its precedents on abortion rights, that that could affect control of the House in next year's elections, white suburban women swing voters aghast at this direction, or anything else?
I think that's kind of an unknown. I think that theory does get thrown around a lot. The Democrats are in such a hole that, you know, the only thing that could get them out of it is some huge, you know, landmark event like overturning Roe, which is not to say that Democrats want to see the, you know, right to an abortion happen, but it could be one of those things that really kind of wakes people up. But, you know, I think that's really untested. This is just something that kind of magazine writers have been debating for like 20 years, you know, is like, would Roe ultimately redound to Democrats' political benefits if it was repealed? Because then the way Republicans have treated the court is such a motivating issue, is something you need to change for so long. Would that then be the Democratic Party that are the ones who are voting based on the court and are taking this much more seriously than I think a lot of Democratic strategists have thought they would? But, you know, it remains to be seen. And I think most Democrats would obviously prefer, you know, to not have Roe v. Wade overturned.
And I wonder if this connects to the article you wrote just recently called Why Democrats' Agenda is So Popular, but Democrats Are Not. Is abortion rights an example of that? Because there is a solid, solid majority in the United States for basic abortion rights.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I it depends on how you phrase things, but, you know, yes, obviously keeping Roe v. Wade on the books is popular. Leaving the right to an abortion there is popular. But that's something that, as Dolly was saying, you know, it's probably not going to get through the Senate, the codification of Roe. And that's something that's a little bit on the back burner. In my article, I was talking about the agenda that Biden's already passed or trying to pass, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, Build Back Better Act, which has a lot of components that people like. It has universal pre-K, capping the cost of drugs and insulin, addressing climate change, a lot of things that individually pull pretty well. And the package itself still has majority support, although it's polarizing a little bit. But you also see Biden's approval rating, you know, in the low 40s and well underwater at this point. And I think that the thing that's coming down to is 70% of people in some of these polls are saying they think the economy is in bad shape. And if you're the party in power when 70% of people think that, then you're going to have a whole lot of problems at the polls. And so there's almost a disconnect between what Democrats are trying to achieve through Congress, which are kind of these long thought goals. They're still pretty popular. And then the economic problems that people are facing every day, whether it's supply shortages or gas prices, grocery prices, worker shortages, just, you know, going into, you know, any store or whatever, and you just notice that shelves are picked and there's not, you know, enough people to help. I think these are things that people are running into every day. And it's people are starting to feel like the Democrats in power are not really touching this.
Jim, changing topics. On January 6th and the January 6th commission, you have a feature that you call This Week in Mark Meadows. And for people who don't know, he was Trump's chief of staff during the January 6th insurrection. Remember, Trump was still president at that point. And Meadows has defied a congressional subpoena to testify about it, but he also turned over a lot of documents to the House committee investigating the riots, including his role potentially and Trump's potential role. What do you make of him cooperating and not cooperating at the same time? How should the public understand this?
Well, I can't make sense of it except outside of him trying to create kind of a swirl of controversy just when his book is coming out. But in doing so, he is kind of putting himself in legal trouble. He's having the worst of both worlds, I would say, in that he's cooperating a little bit, but then stopping cooperating and then, you know, making himself vulnerable to criminal contempt of Congress charges. I think that, you know, it's just been very strange watching him go back on back and forth on this because he also got into hot water earlier when some excerpts from his book were coming out, where he revealed that Trump had tested positive for COVID a few days ahead of a debate. And then when a Trump spokesperson tweeted out that this was a lie, Mark Meadows retweeted that. So I don't know exactly what's going on, except that he likes to live in this kind of world of chaos. But I think this week we're going to see the January 6th committee, because Mark Meadows stopped cooperating, advance criminal contempt charges. And then I think we're going to see a House vote on that. And then it's, you know, depending on who wins the House in 2022, it's going to be kind of a race against the clock here to see how quickly the House committee can get through this report, especially with all the legal cases they're having to work through.
What questions might Meadows or his documents provide answers to? Is it to what degree did Trump actually direct this? To what degree did Trump or Meadows coordinate with groups like the Oath Keepers that might have been planning violence from the start? What questions are they looking to Mark Meadows to really answer?
I think they're looking, you know, they alluded in this report that was released yesterday that there was just waves and waves of text messages sent throughout the day, including to a media personality who had encouraged Trump to issue a statement on January 6th, a member of the family encouraging Trump to put out a statement.
You mean to call off the protesters, the
rioters?
Yeah,
to encourage him to leave because Trump was reticent about doing that. There were some texts that he may have to members of Congress who were involved in this whole Stop the Steal operation following the election. Texts from Meadows to certain rally organizers, potentially. I think that, you know, Meadows is someone who was just kind of constantly on his phone interacting with everyone and was the nexus for everything that happened both after the election, you know, throughout the state legislative process during the state certification of elections, and then also on January 6th. And so they want to get as much as they can from him.
Lisa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lisa.
Hi. First, to get it out of the way, I am a 100% abortion on demand that Roe v. Wade was too limited person. That said, I think this is the wrong conversation to be having right now. Maybe a forest for the trees description. How do I want to put this as succinctly as possible? One of the things that is going on in Texas is what is being called vigilante law, and how the law has been, or how achieving what Texas wants to achieve has been put in the hands, essentially, of bounty hunters. And while this is novel for state law at the moment, it is more of the tip of the iceberg that we have been seeing for quite some time, and I will briefly bring back a discussion. When people were talking about what happens if Trump refuses to leave office, there were calm voices, including on WNYC, saying, don't worry, he can't. The U.S. Marshals will just escort him out of the building. And there were discussions about the impeachment and how the Senate failed to impeach him. Well, now the stories are coming out that many of the senators who might have voted to impeach him were terrified for their families' lives because of death threats. And we are seeing death threats and against poll workers and against election officials. And now we have vigilantes in Texas against abortion rights. Trump never needed to have the army support his actions. If he created and fomented more of the emotions, if he has a nationwide armed militia, then saying calmly about what the Senate can do or what the House can do, wait until you see armed people going and killing or threatening to kill Supreme Court justices, legislatures. This is no longer a calm, considered, let's just wait and see if we can vote it into law or vote this out of law. What is happening is a nationwide coup on a city, state, federal, county level that includes ongoing armed insurrectionists and bounty killers or bounty hunters, and people have been killing abortion doctors and blowing up abortion clinics for decades, is just part of the ongoing wave of tearing apart the structure of the country in support of the Constitution and support of abortion rights are just two of the things that are there. And discussions about what happens to women who can't get abortions and how terrible that is, back to the children at the border, the cruelty is the point. This same authoritarian theocracy right-wing movement is very anti-autonomy for women. So it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And when you focus on the Supreme Court for abortion rights, for voter integrity, you're missing the horrible wave of violence that is and violence threat that is only getting worse.
Lisa, thank you for connecting the dots in that compelling way. I do think we talk about the violent threat a lot as well, but I want to throw Lisa's comments to both of you because it overlaps with both of your beats. Dahlia, first for you, as somebody who covers the courts and the law, I mean, the other thing about this Texas abortion law, we touched on it, but we could go more into it, is how it allows citizens, she calls them vigilantes, certainly bounty hunters, which she also called them, to try to enforce the anti-abortion law for personal monetary gain, getting around the authority of the state, which should leave everybody gobsmacked. Has it ever been done before in this country? And what else would you like to say in response to Lisa's call?
No, I mean, I think Lisa's call nails it. I think that, you know, when SB 8 first was proposed, I wrote a piece saying we are all vigilantes now and making a version of Lisa's point, which is if you look at stand your ground laws and Castle Doctrine, and if you look at exactly the line of laws she's describing, where we are now passing laws in the states that allow people to take it upon themselves to enforce election law if they don't think an election is being conducted fairly. We're seeing laws being passed that allow people to take it upon themselves bring suits if they think that somebody is using the wrong bathroom. And so it is all of a piece with a larger sense of exactly what you just said, mistrust of the state, that the state cannot enforce laws, and therefore we spike it back to, and I think vigilantes is the right word, individuals to enforce the laws themselves. And I find it chilling, which is why when Gavin Newsom proposed this weekend to do a copycat SB 8 law where Californians can be subject to citizen enforcement of gun violations, part of my friends have said, good, it's great to see the same stratagem and plan used against gun owners. But the idea of conscripting everyone in the country to be a vigilante and to self-enforce laws is chilling for the reasons that Lisa says. And the very last thing I would note is that one of the cases that the court is now going to decide that was argued earlier this term would massively expand gun rights and the ability to carry guns in New York City. And so it's not really a hypothetical to talk about, oh, maybe someday armed vigilantes are going to be just determining from themselves what laws they want to enforce and how. I think we are creeping up on a moment where there are going to be a lot more guns and a lot more hands and a lot more people feel empowered to enforce the law themselves. And I find it as chilling as Lisa does.
Is California Governor Gavin Newsom serious? Does he want that same bounty hunter enforcement for gun laws in California that Texas now has for abortions?
I mean, he initially tweeted it, and it seemed like he was just trolling. But in the hours after, he did release a statement saying this is what he's going to ask lawmakers to do, to have the exact same mechanism so that anyone in the country can go ahead and sue somebody in California who violates certain gun laws. It doesn't look like he's just trolling.
Jim Newell, a last word for this segment.
No, I just, you know, in response to Lisa's comments, you know, this intersects most with what I do, just looking at state legislatures and state governments where the whole apparatus of elections, there's efforts, you know, on the Republican side and from Trump's team to put in place people who are more legal or more loyal to the Trump vision and, you know, more willing to do his bidding. We didn't talk about a lot of the Senate races that I wrote about, but all these Senate primaries about loyalty to Trump and who will kind of You know, when Trump asked for the dirty work to be done, who will do it in Congress is something I see every day. So, you know, when we talk about this whole scheme, you know, I think that's what kind of keeps me frightened, is just looking ahead to 2024 and seeing, you know, the extent to which Trump was able to get all these kind of, if he runs again, if he's able to get his will, if it's a close election. So, you know, we can end on that very terrible note, I guess.
With this little addendum, is Dr. Oz yeah. loyal to Trump since you wrote an article about him?
Yes, Dr. Oz has decided that in order to win this election, he will be loyal to Trump. We were talking a lot about abortion rights here. He was outspokenly pro-choice, but now that he's running in a Senate Republican primary in Pennsylvania, he is an ardent pro-lifer. So, yeah, we have yet another race where just someone's jumping in and it's, you know, they're gonna play the hits.
Jim Newell, senior politics writer for Slate, and Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts their podcast, Amicus. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.